And what a night we have for you. In just a moment, Linda Moulton-Howe joins us, our investigative reporter from earthfiles.com, with a series of stories that will simply keep you on the edge of your chair or couch or wherever you might be. She's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. I look forward to this night with Linda Moulton-Howe because, just like you, I sit back and listen to these great stories with wonderment. And we've got a whole series of them. Linda, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, George. It's always great to be on Coast. And one of the big benefits, as you know, is the dialogue with our terrific audience. I get, after each show, a tremendous amount of feedback. And it really is, I hope, a help two ways between people out there and me.
So sure is.
Thank you so much. And this week, the excitement is focused on astronomy. On Monday, September 26th, NASA held a Washington, D.C. teleconference about Hubble telescope searches. In 2012 and 2014, they were looking for signs of atmosphere on one of Jupiter's largest moons, Europa, that is about the size of our Earth's moon. And Hubble 2014 images showed what might have been three different H2O water vapor plumes going up 125 miles above the surface of Europa. And I've got three of the original Hubble images at my news website, earthfiles.com, right now, so you can take a look of where all of this began, along with many of the incredibly great photos of Europa that we are getting now. The question is, what is the source of this water vapor that could be pluming up 125 miles?
Amazing.
People are not certain in the science community if it's intermittent water vapor coming from the 60-foot deep ice crust that could be melting around Europa, or from Europa's big, deep, salty ocean beneath the ice, and that's the important part. That ocean is the deepest in our entire solar system. Europa's ocean is at least 62 miles deep of salty water all around the moon that is beneath this icy crust. And you compare that with Earth, the deepest part of the Mariana Trench is only about 6.8 miles compared to 62 on Europa. And the chances of life being in that ocean go up if that salty water is heated a little by a rocky core of radioactive elements or volcanic eruptions. Now, in 2008, planetary scientist Richard Greenberg, he's a PhD at the University of Arizona, he released a book entitled Unmasking Europa, The Search for Life on Jupiter's Ocean Moon. And in an interview with me at the time, he said, quote, there is strong evidence that the ocean below the ice is connected to the surface through cracks and melting at various times and places. And that big ocean could extend through the ice up to the surface where there is access to oxidants, organic compounds, and light. If there is life there, it would not necessarily be restricted to microorganisms. And he meant there could be swimming creatures in Europa's deep, salty ocean.
Love it.
So probably the best chance of finding current life in our solar system right now would be on Europa, close quote, Professor Greenberg. Well, the Europa discoveries are described by scientists in the September 29th, 2016 issue of the Astrophysical Journal. It just came out. And getting close to Europa to fly through a plume to find out what it's made of, it's the ultimate goal, but wow, is it difficult to get close because of the intense radiation from Jupiter that can fry computer systems. The European Space Agency is going to try in 2022, 6 years from now, with a probe to Europa, and that's going to be followed by a NASA launch of the Europa Multiple Flyby Mission. They're going to look at hotspots on Europa's surface to see, maybe when they're there, that they could get some kind of analysis from vapor plumes if they did erupt. Well, by then, George, Elon Musk wants to launch humans to Mars, where alien life might be found beneath the red planet's surface. And whenever, wherever life is found beyond Earth, it will be one of the biggest paradigm shifts in human history, whether it comes this year, next year, or in the next decade. Well, this is close to home. If we go out into the Milky Way and way beyond, there has been another breakthrough discovery in our universe that is so weird that even the astronomer who discovered it can barely believe it exists. Peter Van Dockham, PhD, professor of astronomy at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, once placed a bet with a colleague that he could build a telescope that would have clear vision of very faint but large cosmic objects. Professor Van Dockham won the bet. Now he has used his unique telescope of 48 telephoto lenses in an array at Cloudcroft, New Mexico, between Alamogordo and Roswell, to find what he calls the dark twin of our Milky Way galaxy. It looks like a smudge. It's 300 light years from Earth, and this dark twin is 99.99% dark matter. It has only 0.1% matter in a few stars, and yet it is a galaxy. He named the eerie and incomprehensible galaxy Dragonfly 44, and he found it with his breakthrough telescope that he calls Dragonfly. Here now from Yale University is astronomer Peter Van Dockham.
There were a bunch of reasons to call it Dragonfly. One is that the special coatings that these lenses have that give them these superb optical qualities were actually inspired by the wings of insects, the way they refract and reflect the light. Also, the telescope's lenses are in an hexagonal pattern, and they kind of resemble compound eyes of insects. We operate the telescope every night. It's robotic. We just send instructions during the day, and then it figures everything out by itself.
So the Dragonfly telescope is completely robotic and takes computer instructions from you wherever you are?
Yes. I've even operated it on a cell phone. All you have to do is, in the afternoon, we come up with a short list of instructions, observe moon, and then when it gets dark, it just gets to work. It checks what the weather is like, and then it starts to take calibration exposures, and when it's dark enough, it starts to go to its first target and focuses itself and sends us updates.
So Dragonfly 44 is the 44th very faint galaxy that you discovered and photographed with your Dragonfly telescope. But to your surprise, this massive galaxy, 300 light years from Earth, turns out to be almost all dark matter.
Yeah, that's correct. It is an extraordinary object. We knew that it was a strange galaxy when we first saw it because it's very large. It's as big as the Milky Way. We measured motions of the stars in this galaxy. That, in turn, gave us information on how much mass there was. And then it turned out that it's as heavy as the Milky Way is. So it's as big as the Milky Way, it's as heavy as the Milky Way, but it only has 1% of the stars of the Milky Way.
Wow.
And that led us to conclude that this galaxy, very unusually, is almost entirely made up of dark matter.
How did you find Dragonfly 44 if it is 99% dark matter?
We built this telescope to find exactly these kinds of things, things that are so faint that other telescopes just look through them, basically. So this galaxy and galaxies like it span a fairly large area on the sky. They're not small, but they're very, very faint because they have so few stars. And so a lot of other people had looked at this area of the sky and had just not noticed this galaxy. It was sitting there all the time, but people just didn't pick it up. And then when we built Dragonfly telescope and we looked at this area of sky, we saw all these faint smudges in the Dragonfly image, almost like you have a little smudge on your lens of your camera.
Hmm.
And then we started to investigate these smudges, what they might be. And that ultimately led to the conclusion that they are these giant galaxies that have very few stars.
It's this issue of yin and yang as a metaphor for opposites in this universe that are juxtaposed with each other.
Yeah, it is fascinating that Dragonfly 44, with its very few stars and its huge amount of dark matter, and then the Milky Way, which is where we live, dominated by normal matter. We don't understand that yet, why there's this large diversity in galaxies, and we need to figure that out.
What are astronomers' speculations about what dark matter is and where it came from?
Well, one extreme is that dark matter does not really exist as a particle, but that it is a change is required in Newton's laws. So some people have speculated that perhaps Newton's laws do apply on Earth and on solar system, but on the scale of galaxies, perhaps a revision is required. And that means that when we determine how much mass there is based on the motions of stars, we're making an error in that equation, and we should be using a different equation that would lead to a normal amount of mass and no dark matter at all. But those theories have difficulty explaining a lot of the phenomena that we see in the sky, in galaxies and also in galaxy clusters, large groups of galaxies. I think most astronomers would guess that the dark matter is a particle, and it's certainly something that is real. I mean, when I say certainly, I mean that's what most astronomers think, that dark matter is something that you could touch. It's a thing, rather than a force or something that is not tangible. But until we find the particle, it's an open question, and it dominates the mass in the universe, so it's embarrassing that we don't know what most of the stuff in the universe is made of.
Okay, there is so much confusion about dark matter. Can you now give a general world audience your perspective on what it means to say that this Dragonfly 44 galaxy is 99% dark matter?
Dark matter is really a mysterious substance, and we don't know what it is. We can only detect it because of its influence it has on other things. That makes it mysterious. It's something that we haven't discovered yet. It's very strange, because if you haven't discovered something, why would you even talk about it? But we can't get around the dark matter because of its influence on everything else. We can see what it does, even though we don't know what it is. An example would be that even if we couldn't see the sun, we would still know it's there because of the motions of the Earth. We know that the Earth goes around some object. You know, it takes a year for the Earth to go around the sun. We can measure how fast the Earth moves and how far away it is from the sun or from that point in space. And then we could actually determine how massive the sun is, how much it weighs, just from the motion of the Earth, without ever having looked at the sun. And this is how we found the dark matter. It exerted a gravitational pull on everything that has dark matter, but we don't know what it is that causes that pull. We think it's some elementary particle that hasn't been discovered yet. People are looking for it. And the actual discovery of the dark matter particle is one of those holy grails in science that everybody would love to discover. But right now, we still don't know.
Isn't it true that astronomers say that dark matter is what holds galaxies together, what would keep the Milky Way in the shape it is with all of the vast numbers of suns? If the dark matter were not there, that essentially the disk shape of the Milky Way might tatter and dissipate in some way. And that if you go to Dragonfly 44, the astonishing thing is that even 1% are stars. If the dark matter were not the other 99%, those stars wouldn't be there.
Yeah, that is essentially correct. We measure the velocities of stars, so how fast they're moving, both in the Milky Way and in Dragonfly 44. And then we know that something must hold the galaxy together, otherwise it would just fly apart. The stars are moving so fast that there has to be some unseen matter that keeps the galaxy together. And even before we measured the velocities in Dragonfly 44, we knew that something must be there to hold the thing together. So few stars that just its movement through space and interactions with other galaxies would very quickly disrupt the whole galaxy and tear it apart. Such a tenuous object, it can only survive if it has a huge amount of unseen mass that holds it together. So we already knew or suspected that it might have a lot of dark matter. How much it has was a surprise. It seems to be this dark twin of the Milky Way.
A dark twin of the Milky Way. Can you explain to a general audience why would there even be one like Dragonfly 44 that would be only 1% of visible matter and 99% whatever mysterious dark matter is?
Well, the exciting thing is that I can't, and nobody can.
In the confusion about whether dark matter is a particle or not, is it possible that the concept of multi-universes, groups of universes, could explain that dark energy and dark matter are related to forces and influences in gravity because we are close to other universes that we haven't detected yet?
Yeah, until we actually know what these things are and until we detect the dark matter particle, there's a lot of room for exciting other options.
Since matter galaxies like the Milky Way galaxy are all now supposed to have a black hole at the center, does Dragonfly 44 have a black hole at the center of all this dark matter?
That is an excellent question, and I'd love to know the answer to that.
And I would too.
We all would.
This whole area of dark energy, dark matter, what are black holes really, other dimensions, parallel universes, it is now in my discussions with astronomers I am beginning to understand that the multiverse, multiple dimensions in which there are perhaps an infinite number of universes, like here's one that we're in, 13.9 billion light years, that there could be an infinite number of other universes and that the influence of universe to universe, if they are grouped in a way that we don't even have any comprehension of, could be some kind of an influence that eventually we may find is what is behind dark matter and dark energy. But in the meantime, one of the big things that he and other astronomers are just bating breath, they are so eager, is the James Webb Telescope. And when we come back after this break, he and I are going to talk more about that, Dragonfly, and some other mysteries.
Isn't it amazing, Linda, what technology can do in terms of getting us the information we all seek?
Well, it's, think of this. He is using his iPhone, his cell phone, to communicate with this one-of-a-kind Dragonfly telescope that is unique on this planet. And if we didn't have the Dragonfly, we would never know that there is a galaxy out there 300 light years, 99.99% dark matter, and no one can even understand how that's possible.
No. Do you think we'll really get these answers?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that if humans survive themselves and we do not have some nuclear conflagration in the next 10 or 15 years, that we will make it over this hump, I hope, and that exploring the solar system and the universe, that is the legacy that I think Homo sapiens sapien has. And that's what's happening. Elon Musk is going to go to Mars. We've got those little wafer craft that are going to go to Alpha Centauri. We have this telescope that is reaching out 300 million light years and is seeing something that is made out of something that we cannot see, but we know because of the influence of gravity, and we still don't fully understand what gravity's relationship is to all the fundamental forces in the universe. This is breakthrough time, George, on so many levels. This is the time when we are beginning to learn what kind of universe we're in and who are we.
Yes, I wonder if we'll ever touch the face of God, Linda.
That's part of what all this is.
We're going to come back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe. She's got more great stories for you. Don't go away. We're going to come back in a moment with more with Linda Moulton Howe as we talk about these incredible stories that she covers. And welcome back. Let's go back out into space with Linda Moulton Howe. She's still on planet Earth, though. Hi, Linda.
Yeah, but we are headed out there between now and 2018. A lot is going to happen. And one of the most anticipated astronomy breakthroughs since the Hubble and the Spitzer Space Telescopes is expected to come from the James Webb Space Telescope. and it's now scheduled for launch in October 2018, 2 years, what they call the JWST. It will have the Earth's best resolution and sensitivity ranging from long wavelength visible light in the orange-red frequency through near-infrared to the mid-infrared. And it has a theme, to see the first light, meaning this telescope wants to go back as far in time to the beginning of this universe as possible. And it will have great clarity of vision because it's going to be launched to what is called the second Lagrange point, 930,000 miles from Earth, where there is a combined gravitational pull between the Earth and the Sun that will allow the James Webb Telescope, it's going to be on its own little spacecraft, to circle around this Lagrange 2 point. It's known as a halo orbit, and it means that there will be enough gravitational balance that the JWST, the James Webb Telescope, will always stay near this Lagrange 2 point out there with crystal vision because there will be no atmosphere from the Earth. And once it's in place, the James Webb Telescope is going to be trying to see back in time as far as possible to the Big Bang, to understand how stars and planets form, and looking at what the conditions are for origins of life. They want to study the universe in all this infrared, which is, in contrast, Hubble has been seeing invisible or ultraviolet light. James Webb is going to be able to see in infrared frequencies. And they want to see if they can solve the mystery of that star, KIC 846-2852, that has become famous for these great variations in the dimming light that's provoked the question, did an intelligent civilization build some kind of an energy production device or something around that star? Well, that's one of the things that James Webb is going to be trying to solve. And Professor Van Dockham at Yale University, he would add a fifth category to what he'd like James Webb to do, and that's to look at his catalog of faint, massive objects, such as the nearly all dark matter galaxy Dragonfly 44, to see what more might be seen in infrared that might shed some light on this huge dark matter galaxy out there, the dark twin of our Milky Way, as he calls it. And what we're going to do now is to talk about James Webb, more Dragonfly, and other mysteries. Here now from Yale University is Professor Peter Van Dockham.
Can the new Webb telescope look at Dragonfly 44 and see it more clearly?
Yes, we're all very excited about the James Webb telescope, which will launch in 2018. It's a successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's going to be an astonishing machine. We are planning to propose to look at Dragonfly 44 and perhaps other galaxies like it, because it will provide a much clearer view of this galaxy. It will also be able to measure the amount of dark matter much further away from where we've measured it so far, so we can get a much better measurement of how much dark matter there is, and also of the nature of the stars in this galaxy, when they formed, and hopefully learn how these galaxies came to be. So the James Webb Space Telescope will change and revolutionize a lot of fields of astronomy. And for us, it comes at a great time, because we're finding these galaxies that really push our current telescopes to the limits.
Does it mean that when the Webb Telescope launches in 2018, that there might even be a computer network between the Webb, the Dragonfly, Keck, Hubble, so that all of the telescopes could talk to each other?
Yeah, and some of that actually already exists, because sometimes there's an explosion in the sky, that's a supernova explosion or a gamma ray burst explosion, and then the key is to very quickly point as many telescopes at that location in the sky as possible. As soon as a supernova is detected, it sends a signal to a bunch of telescopes, and they will, sometimes within seconds, move to that position and start taking images without a human ever being in the middle.
Wow.
Yeah, it is really astonishing what can be done these days.
And who is the traffic cop amid the telescopes? In other words, how do the telescopes talk to each other?
Well, that's a very good question. It is tricky to figure those things out. Particularly, a telescope might be doing something for researcher A, and then all of a sudden there's this supernova goes off, and researcher B says, stop what you're doing, telescope, move to my supernova. And so this is where these committees come in, time allocation committees, who try to make judgment calls on what things should get priority. So you try to anticipate what might happen, and then there's rules that govern who gets priority if something happens that requires one of these interrupts. It's tricky because there's often competing teams that want to do the same thing. In our case, we don't have to worry about that because it's our telescope and we have 100% of time on it.
Are the committees around the world in both hemispheres or only in the United States, or how does that work?
Well, telescopes have their own committees, like the Keck telescopes have a committee, European telescopes have their committee, and it's usually who owns and operates the telescope gets to decide. The U.S. operates a bunch of telescopes, the U.S. committee decides on these things, but some international telescopes, like the Hubble Space Telescope, it's an international committee, and it meets in Baltimore in the United States every year. But there's a lot of people from Europe and from South America, and China, Japan, who fly into Baltimore and participate in these meetings to decide what should be observed.
So if something were coming into our solar system, let's say some large rogue asteroid that we hadn't known before, and maybe it's 6 miles in diameter, an extinction event, is that the kind of thing where the telescope network would send out an urgent request for all telescopes around the world to look at it?
Yeah, although in that particular case, I think we'd all be hiding under our desk and hoping for the best. But yeah, more generally, if something truly exciting happens, ultimately the directors of these telescopes have authority to stop whatever the telescope is doing and change the program.
Is it true that if a star explodes with a tremendous amount of gamma ray energy, that it could wipe out all surface life on Earth, depending upon the distance?
Well, I don't want to alarm your listeners, but yes, it could do that. There's this class of explosions called gamma ray bursts, and they're extremely energetic. Some people even have linked past extinction events on Earth to gamma ray burst events. If a gamma ray burst went off close to the Earth, it would not be a good day.
What would determine whether a star exploded with a tremendous gamma ray burst or not?
Oh, it's not well known. But we do know that the star has to be very massive before it can produce the gamma ray burst. It has to explode in what's called a supernova. What we didn't know is that some of these supernovae are accompanied by this enormous burst of gamma rays, incredibly energetic particles. On Earth, nuclear explosions, extremely harmful rays that can obliterate life. It's not that well understood why some stars do this, some stars don't.
What is the closest star that might burst that's large and could emit a lot of gamma rays?
That's an interesting question. The first thing that comes to mind is Eta Carinae, which is one of the most massive stars in our galaxy, and it's also nearing the end of its life.
In addition to Dragonfly 44, is there anything else that you have discovered that you are excited about as another huge mystery?
Well, one thing is that galaxies continuously grow by eating other galaxies. They have quite an appetite, and any galaxy in the universe has either recently eaten a small other galaxy, or it will do so soon. So galaxies are cannibals. They eat each other. And the question is, how much do they eat? What did they eat recently? What will they eat in the future? And how much will they grow through this process? The answer is quite a lot. And they all look completely different. One has eaten a lot. Another has been on a starvation diet and has not eaten anything in a long time. One thing that we're trying to understand is what determines the eating habits of a galaxy and how does that change over time.
What is the Milky Way galaxy eating?
The Milky Way has quite an appetite. It is currently eating a galaxy called Sagittarius Dwarf that's in the process of being disrupted and merging with the Milky Way.
And the next logical step is we have to be finding other life in this universe. It's preposterous that a 13.9 billion light year universe, that Earth in the backwater of the Milky Way galaxy would be the only planet with intelligent humanoids?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, we have, of course, discovered a lot of planets around other stars, and Proxima B, this latest incredible discovery of a potentially Earth-like planet in the habitable zone around Earth, near a star. So one big uncertainty in that whole question has been resolved. The question, how rare is it to have planets, and particularly planets like Earth? Not rare at all. Many, many stars have them. There's a huge diversity of solar systems in our galaxy. And so that is an incredibly exciting result, because it means that there certainly is a lot of potential for life to develop. There's a lot of locations where that could have happened.
Like Michio Kaku argues that we are on a 4.6 billion year old Earth and solar system, so we would be in the one-third most recent part of the universe, with two-thirds of the universe older than we are.
Yeah, of course. But what is unknown in that argument is how likely it is for life to develop in the first place. That's the big question that we don't have an answer to. I think the empirical scientific approach of looking and trying to find as many planets as we can and then study those planets, look for biosignatures. We want to find out how many Earth-like planets there are, how many of them have an atmosphere that looks somewhat like Earth's, and particularly with oxygen. And then the next steps are to survey those planets in greater detail and to understand more of their chemistry and see if there's any direct evidence for things that we have on Earth, like plants. And I think it's a very fruitful approach. It'll get us closer, perhaps not directly in contact with aliens, but it will answer the next set of questions. And it's exciting that we have those. If we hadn't discovered all those planets around other stars, we'd be done at this point. There would be nothing else to search for, but there is, and that's exciting.
I talked to an astronomer once who had a hypothesis that if we knew the truth, that this universe was only one of maybe a group, say that there are 10 universes, and that each universe had some sort of an electromagnetic membrane separating it from its group, we might have a twin universe where everything was the opposite of this universe. The influence of other universes that we do not detect could be the explanation for things like multiverses, other dimensions, dark matter, and dark energy.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And that idea, I think, has been put forward mostly to try to explain the existence of the dark energy, which is in some sense even more strange than the dark matter, because the dark energy you can see as an anti-gravity that pushes everything apart and speeds up the universe, rather than the dark matter, which at least knows how to behave in terms of its gravity. It has a positive gravity, the attractive force. It doesn't cause the expansion of the universe to speed up. Yeah, I think most people believe that the universe is just one of a huge number of universes. They might interact in some way. The number of dimensions could be different in different universes. The laws of physics could be different. Our universe could be sort of an accidental one where we wonder greatly about why there is this amount of dark matter. One universe over, everything could be slightly different. I think most astronomers would say there's probably many, many universes, also many different realities within this universe.
That's exciting.
And that is a step forward, that astronomers are now talking very frankly and openly about all of these subjects. Once upon a time, they weren't so public, and they are now. And meanwhile, back home in our own solar system, on Wednesday this week, September 28th, Elon Musk spoke at the International Astronautical Congress in Guadalajara, Mexico, to unveil his plans for colonizing Mars. He called his talk, quote, "Making Humans a Multiplanetary Species." And Musk envisions a fleet of some 1,000 spaceships transporting eventually as many, he says, as 1 million people from Earth to Mars. And Musk announced that he wants to build massive rockets that can be parked in orbit around Earth in order to make them more easily accessible, like a shuttle between Earth and Mars. And he envisions that each large spacecraft with its booster would be about 400 feet long. That's bigger than a football field. And it could carry as many as 100 passengers at a time. And Elon Musk wants to rapidly build up a population of humans on the red planet. And with more humans living on Mars, Musk thinks that methane and liquid oxygen fuel could be mined right there on Mars to fuel his space shuttles. And how much would it cost each passenger to make this possible one-way trip to Mars? Well, Musk says if you figure that his total development cost for the Earth-Mars shuttle will be $10 billion, then he thinks he could get the ticket price down to $200,000 per passenger. And what is Elon Musk's timetable for his Earth-to-Mars space fleet shuttle? He says with technical support from NASA, he would like to launch his first unmanned test spacecraft called Dragon to Mars in 2018, same year for the launch of the James Webb Telescope. And then by 2022 or thereabouts, Musk thinks that he could launch his first manned mission to Mars. Everything is changing, George.
And the price is going to come down for individuals?
Well, $200,000 right now. And that's not firm. But, you know, when you think about the fact that Elon Musk, who has Tesla and SpaceX, and he seems to even be urgently pushing that we need to get to Mars, and those little wafer craft that I talked about on Coast a couple of months ago, the excitement of being able to use lasers to get small weight but highly intelligent little machines going from here to Alpha Centauri and doing it at 20 to 30% of the speed of light so that you could get to Alpha Centauri, where there might be a rocky planet like Earth, in 17 years. This is a time of revolution.
It really is. And it seems like a lot of these scientists are so far ahead of the game that these things are going to happen.
I really think that if humans are to survive, it is our destiny to move out into the solar system and the Milky Way galaxy. And, of course, I've interviewed people on Coast like William Mills Tompkins, who did work for the U.S. Navy in World War II, and says we already have intergalactic trade, that there are all kinds of things that our country has been doing with various kinds of non-humans. And even though that seems like a jump from the straight astronomy, they are both compatible. It is just proving and then bringing both sides of this equation, other life in the universe and the science of Earth, together.
What's on tap next hour?
We are going to get an update on animal mutilations, which is a part of this big global mystery about an alien presence.
More to come with Linda Moulton Howe right here on Coast to Coast AM.